come along with us as we explore the broad world of preservation and the work being done to preserve, interpret, and save our past in a 21st century world. From aquaculture to historic foodways to forensic modeling, we're talking weekly with experts from across the globe. This is your host, Nick Redding. Welcome to PreserveCast. This is Nick Redding. You're listening to PreserveCast, and we're thrilled today to be chatting with Annie Polland, who is the president at the Tenement Museum in New York City. And we're going to be talking all about their work, how she got into that work, and a new exhibit that they have opening called A Union of Hope. And we'll be learning about what that means and how you can go and see it and learn more about it. But before we get there, Annie, we love to get to know people that we're chatting with. So where did you grow up and what kind of put you on the path to working in museums like the one that you work at now?
Oh, it's great to be here at PreserveCast. I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so very different from New York City. But I think one of the things, as I look back, one of the things that got me interested in the past and, you know, how we talk about the past and how we help people experience the past was an exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum called The Streets of Old Milwaukee, where they had basically taken several streets of a kind of turn of the century, turn of the 20th century streetscape, and recreated it in a way that you walked through the cobblestone, you walked on the cobblestone roads through and were able to peek into the stores. I think even go inside some of the stores, just really gates, you know, fences were put up, and it was so all encompassing, so immersive. It really sparked the imagination. And then right next to that exhibit was a kind of companion exhibit. I can't remember the name, but it actually looked at the different cultures, the different immigrant groups that had come and settled in Milwaukee. And you could kind of, again, peek inside the room and see it, like, you know, an Italian household or an Irish household or a Jewish household. And I just remember being fascinated with that, you know, thinking about how did people who had come from different places bring their traditions to this very landscape and streetscape. And so I think that fired up my imagination to learn more and to study history.
That's interesting because I've heard about that exhibit. I have another colleague who they say that that's the reason that they got involved in preservation and history was that exhibit. And I from what I understand, and I don't know if it changed, they removed that and there was great public despair and outrage about the removal of that exhibit, I think. So it obviously touched a lot of people's hearts.
Yeah, I think there's plans to reassemble it. I believe the museum had to like basically build a new building, which is unfortunate because they were in a really a phenomenal building. But I think there were some structural issues and they realized that it would cost more to fix those than to build a new, which again, is quite rare. But so I think they're redoing it in the new place, but it might be different. I don't know. I don't know how they can recapture it, but I hope that they try. Certainly,
yeah.
It was formative.
Yeah, it must have been something pretty special. So where was your first job in the field? How did you, you know, you had the interest, and then what was your sort of path to New York City from where you were?
From the age of 5 and going to Streets of Milwaukee to how I am where I am at the age of 50. In short, I studied all sorts of stuff at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and then went to Columbia for graduate school in history and got my PhD. And while I was there, I worked as a tour guide for a company called Big Onion Walking Tours. And Big Onion Walking Tours was composed of graduate students. And you basically led historical walking tours of various neighborhoods in New York City. And so my first tour was of the Lower East Side. And so it was actually connected to the Tenement Museum at that point. And was able to give tours of the kind of the built environment, so much of which still exists on the Lower East Side. And so that was kind of my introduction, I guess, to public history. At the same time, I was studying, you know, the historiography and all the primary sources that compose the history. It was amazing to kind of be on the streets and teaching that to real people. So I think that would be my like moment of like, oh, I want to do this. So I did that. I finished my dissertation. I taught. And again, I knew I wanted to stay in New York City because through teaching the history of New York City through the streets just kind of became so connected to it. And so I did not apply for any academic jobs, but there was a job opening up at the museum at Eldred Street, which is a National Historic Landmark. And at that point was in the process of being restored to, you know, kind of what it looked like at the turn of the 20th century, and worked there as the restoration was being completed, and did work on educational programs and scholarly programs, and wrote a book about the history. And so was there for about 4 years, and then came to the Tenement Museum as the head of education and programs, and was in that role for, I don't know, almost 8-9 years, and then left for a little bit to run a historical society near Union Square, the American Jewish Historical Society, and was there for about 3 years, and then came back as president of the Tenement Museum in January of 2021. So I guess my path to this role has really been through content, but the kind of the idea of thinking beyond academia to how to make history come alive for people.
Yeah, and obviously something about this neighborhood really sparked something in you, because it seems like it's a common thread throughout your whole career, is this place and the built environment of this place. For people who aren't familiar with the Tenement Museum, and it was really sort of at the forefront of this new social history in the mid 20th century, talk to us about not so much what it preserves, but the decision, I guess, or the creation of the museum. And then we'll talk about the actual history of the site. But this was sort of a new thing, and was riding the wave, and a lot of others have followed it now, but it was sort of out there early on. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the field of social history is kind of grew and was, you know, became central in the probably the 1960s and 1970s. And by the 1980s, 1988, there are two women, Ruth Abram and Anita Jacobson, who really wanted to tell the stories of immigrants on the Lower East Side, and we're looking for a tenement to do that, and found Tenement at 97 Orchard through a variety of ways. But they knew that that tenement was the one kind of magical moment of walking into this building and seeing that, from in many respects, while the lower levels had been maintained as stores and had changed over time as stores, and that's what kind of kept the building going. Since the mid-1930s, no one had lived in this building that they discovered in 1988. So it was really on the upper floors, a kind of time capsule that allowed them to imagine what it was like to live in the building at different moments. And so that kind of began the launch, or that launched the concept of the Tenement Museum. I mean, I think they had the idea of the museum before they found the tenement, but then they found the tenement, and then it kind of evolved in a variety of ways. But I think there were three things that were pretty radical about that founding and the kind of decisions made pretty early on in the museum's history. One was that it was going to tell the story of working class people, people who never thought that their lives would be the subject matter of a museum. So that was huge, right? You know, so many historic houses are portraying the lives of famous people, inventors, presidents, generals, you know, all sorts of kind of people whose names are already in textbooks. And they decided they're going to tell the story of people who are mentioned in textbooks by way of numbers or categories, but not as individuals, and to make those individual lives central. That was radical. So that was number one. Number two is that they were going to tell the story of a variety of different groups. Now, many museums kind of, for a variety of reasons, focus on kind of one group or another. So you can have a Chinese museum, a Japanese American museum, an Arab American museum, a Jewish museum. You can have all of these different museums that focus for good reasons on an entire group who, you know, when you look at it closely, really are made up of a bunch of different groups that fall under that single category. But what the Tenement Museum did, and what they realized early on, that they wanted to tell the diversity of stories that they could about the Lower East Side. And so that means it wasn't going to be just a Jewish museum or just an Italian museum. It was going to try to span the scope of the folks who lived in the Lower East Side over time. And that's number two. And then number three is that the other thing that evolved that I think was pretty radical. It's both radical and old fashioned. And that is that everyone would experience the museum under the guide of a trained educator who would walk you through the museum. You would experience the museum in a group. So in other words, you don't just show up and say, get a ticket and walk around on your own. You're led in a group, and it's a storytelling experience. And so, you know, you show up and you meet people from different parts of the country who are visiting the museum, and you're led through this story, because it's through the story that the lives of the folks who live there are brought to life. And it's almost like a kind of, when it works really well, I think it's like a kind of communal storytelling, and a way, an active storytelling where, you know, people are asking questions, it's interactive. And I think that is pretty radical, because I think now so many places for a variety of reasons are using like acoustic guides, or you're able to just walk around the building. But I think because the museum prioritized these stories, that's the way that we continue to run today.
Yeah, it's a fascinating place, and it I didn't know that piece about the upstairs being sort of vacant for almost, I guess at that point, you know, close to 50 years. So talk to people about the experience of visiting. So if they do visit, obviously we know that it's a storytelling experience. There's a group that kind of takes you through this. What are the stories that you'll be sort of exposed to? Are they always changing? I know we're going to talk about this new exhibit, so understandably there are obviously exhibit spaces, but who might they meet on this experience? Mm-hmm.
So there are, I guess, at this point, so the Tenement Museum now encompasses two different buildings, two different tenements. The tenement that Anita and Ruth discovered in 1988, 97 Orchard. But the museum purchased another building on the corner, 103 Orchard, that everyone starts their experience in. It's our gift shop, our bookshop, and all our tours begin then. So that becomes a kind of centralized focus place. But in addition, on the third floor of this building are also exhibits. So we have a total of about 12 exhibit spaces that you would experience through 8 different tours. So you come in and you can choose from about 8 different building tours in the building. And so some of those building tours encompass 2 families, sometimes it's 1 family. You can also do walking tours and other ways of experiencing the neighborhood. And so those stories span from 1863 when the building opened to the 1980s when you still had residents in this building. And so you can pick what tour you go on. And again, some of those tours encompass 1 family, some 2 families. And then you go to the apartments that have been recreated. You'll see recreated apartments. You also see ruined apartments, and the ruined apartments are kind of rooms that haven't been, that have actually been preserved to look as they did in 1988 when the building discovered. So that there's this idea that you see recreated apartments that match a particular time period, but also these kind of ruins. So you get to discover the building on your own too.
So in 8 tours and all these spaces, how big is the organization that backs all this up? How big is your staff? How big is your team to make all this happen? You know, in a pretty expensive area too. This is probably one of the more expensive places in the world to manage a museum. I mean, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
In New York City, and particularly where you're at too. This is no easy task. So I'm just curious the scale of what you're doing here.
Yeah, no, it's a great, great question. So our staff is about 50 full-time employees and then about 60 to 70 part-time employees. So a lot of our educators are part-time. And that is a lot to manage. We have about a $12 million annual budget, which is a weird place to be because we're not a small museum, but we're also not like the Whitney or the Guggenheim. And one of the things I like to joke about is that when it was Lucas Glockner was the first landlord, and he was responsible for building 97 Orchard in 1863. And my favorite joke these days is that I wish he had set aside some money for an endowment for the museum, because we'd be in a much different place if we had an endowment that started in 1863. So we're a really, it's like a weird thing where we're a very scrappy museum in a lot of ways. Like, we're just kind of trying to like do the best thing we can. And that scrappiness, I think, is good because it allows us to be responsive and creative. But there are certainly things that we are envious of some of the larger institutions that have more well-established endowments and, you know, financial setups, because it is, as you say, it is hard to run a museum, a cultural organization in New York City.
Yeah. And obviously when it started, it was very unique, very radical, as you said. Is it singular, or do you have peers, not just in New York, but across the country now, that tell these types of stories that you're talking about, not the story of the general or the president, but the story of the average person? Is there a network of these places? So if someone's listening and they live in a different part of the country and they don't have a chance to get to the Tenement Museum or not yet, mm-hmm. are there places that they should be looking, or a network of people that tell these stories, or is it still sort of informal?
That's a good question. I think there are more formal ways in which people in museums are connected. There are other like-minded museums. I would say the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle, Washington. And again, I think there's more of an emphasis throughout the world or throughout the country on telling telling unheard stories. So the International Sites of Conscience has like a network of migration museums, for example. So that's one way to kind of connect.
Yeah, it seems like there's still work to be done in this space, that there could be more of these in communities around the country, that there's still a lot of ground and a lot of stories to be told. I know we talked to people in Chicago creating a public housing museum.
Oh, yeah, of course. So, thank you for, Lisa Lee. And I just visited, which I'm so excited for that to open. I got a tour of the construction site. That is super exciting. Yeah, absolutely. And it's neat to see the ways in which, you know, Lisa Lee and her staff have taken like some of the ideas that we have put into practice here, but like then, because of the differences of the site that they're in, can like do different things with art and all different kinds of creative ideas to make those spaces come alive. So that definitely feels like a museum that we're in conversation with and can learn from now.
So talk to us about the new exhibit that people can expect to see, The Union of Hope, which chronicles the African-American experience on site, or at least one part of the African-American experience on site, and the story of Joseph and Rachel Moore. So where did this come about, and how does this kind of tie into the broader experience of visiting the Tenement Museum?
Great. So I think in some ways, and this is what I love. So remember when I said that one of the things that made the Tenement Museum somewhat unique is that our experiences are led by educators, and we try to create interactive experiences in which visitors ask questions. And in the best case scenario, visitors will ask questions that we don't know the answer to, and that will spark research, and then that creates new tours. That's what I like to call the tenement cycle. Like, we take questions we can't answer, we go to scholars, we do research, and we create something new. So whenever I lead that tour, I actually say this tour came about because of a question a visitor asked. So I encourage you to ask a question so you can then come back and go on a new tour. But what we were telling, story of an Irish family, Joseph and Bridget Moore, who lived at 97 Orchard. And we shared with our visitors a city directory. A city directory is the 19th century, you know, document that was the kind of version of the Yellow Pages or maybe LinkedIn in some form, but just basically goes alphabetically, lists people's names, says their occupation and their residence. And that's about it. But when we were showing the city directory for Joseph Moore, the Irish Joseph Moore, who lived at 97 Orchard, basically we were just saying, like, here's a source that shows you that we know what we're talking about and that he really lived here. Fine. But visitors started to notice a Joseph Moore who lived at 17 Lawrence. This Joseph Moore was listed directly above the Joseph Moore 97 Orchard Street. And next to his name in parentheses, it said COL'D. Which was the 19th century abbreviation, which was an abbreviation for the 19th century term color to refer to people of African descent. And that immediately sparked all sorts of conversation. What was it like for this man with the same name, same job, living in New York at the same time? What would his life have been like? And we eventually started to research that, and we found more about Joseph and Rachel Moore than we found out about Joseph and Bridget Moore, actually. And we're able to realize, like, we had the makings of an exhibit that dovetailed with a construction project and a preservation project we were doing for the whole building of 97 Orchard that enabled us to strengthen the fifth floor of our building, which had not previously seen visitors because it wasn't properly stabilized for visitors. And so because that project was happening, we realized we could tell Joseph Moore's story at our building. And this was a departure in the sense that it was the first time we were telling the story of people who did not live in our building. But our research revealed that there were reasons why they didn't live in our building, and that it was very hard for Black New Yorkers to live in neighborhoods that didn't have a strong number, a large number of other Black New Yorkers. And so it seemed kind of arbitrary at that point to say, oh, we're not going to tell that story because they didn't live in our building. What could be the challenge? How can we tell their story in our building, but still be really specific that they didn't live in our building and make that an exhibit? And that's what we did. And I think this exhibit, in some ways, it could be the first tour you ever see at the Tenement Museum, because in laying this out and describing kind of how we came to this story, we're also talking about the methodology of the museum and talking about the past work of the museum and really exposing people and bringing them along our journey and sharing the primary sources that shows how we got to what we're doing. And so in some ways, what we've always strive to do on our tours is show people how we know what we know. And I think this tour does that. It helps us recreate this community of the Eighth Ward, which is now present day Soho, which has no historic fabric or very little historic fabric that dates from this time. And what we found out, of course, was that Lauren Street is West Broadway. So, you know, we'll say Lauren Street and then we tell our visitors West Broadway, and many of them are familiar with Soho because if they're tourists, they've gone shopping in Soho. But this is an opportunity to kind of reveal a history that can no longer be told. Ironically, can no longer be told at that block because there is no historic fabric. But what we've done in our building with historic fabric is kind of explain and resurrect in some ways that neighborhood, the communal networks. We draw heavily on the Black press and maps. And then we recreate their two-room apartment, would have been a rear tenement apartment made up of two rooms, and show the people that Joseph and Rachel lived with in 1870 when we find them on the census.
And I guess in a way it opens up a lot of other stories. Now that you're comfortable sort of telling an offsite story on site, it allows, I mean, the canvas of New York is yours now. I mean, you could tell a lot of stories now that you've kind of gone down this road. How long does an exhibit like that stay open for? If people came and visited, you know, in the next 6 months, will it be there? How long will they get a chance to see this?
In perpetuity. I mean, once we create an exhibit, it stays. So we have, like I said, 12 exhibits from the beginning. You know, our first apartment was the Gumperts family and the Baldizi family, Italian family. The Baldizi family was, of course, Italian Catholic, and the Gumperts family is a German Jewish family from the 1870s. Those have been there from the very beginning, and they're still there. But what I would say, in addition, the Levine family, the Broguszewski family, Eastern European Jewish families, the Confino family, a Sephardic Jewish family, the Epstein family, a family who survived the Holocaust, the Wong family, a Chinese family, the Saez Velez family, a Puerto Rican family, the Schneider family, who ran a German lager beer saloon. So, like, we keep adding stories, but we don't take any away. But what I would say, though, is that in adding more stories and getting more perspectives on life in New York, we can go back and actually infuse the pre-existing tours and exhibits with new information and new perspectives. So what we hear often from our visitors is, I went on this tour and then I came back 2 years later and I had a different educator, so I had a different perspective, but I also learned new things. We're constantly adding new content to the tours we tell because the field of history is ever evolving and new discoveries are made. And so we work with scholars to figure out, okay, how should we update this tour and what new information can we add to it? And because we're not a place with wall text, we're a place that has tour content and we don't have scripts, so much to say as we, it's about training our educators to engage in ever richer conversations with our visitors.
So at what point do you need a third building?
I think it's more our goals now, to go back to your question about the expenses of living in New York and running an organization in New York, which only increase. I see our canvas as somewhat different. Rather than thinking about our canvas with regard to bricks and mortar, it's more about kind of consolidating what we have. It's about bringing more ideas to play to create temporary exhibits, temporary tours, so that we're able to kind of highlight different connections. So for example, this December, we want to tell about a story about Christmas and look at how Christmas evolves in the tenements. And we'll look at a German Lutheran family in the 1870s, how did they celebrate Christmas, to an Italian family in the 1930s, how did they celebrate Christmas, to the Puerto Rican. So we're using our exhibits, our spaces, but we're doing different themes that we can tell. We can also do another tour about the turn of the century bar mitzvah. Like, what did that look like by exploring? So how can we actually, you know, keep the tours we have, keep those spaces, but add new content and new stories that help us shine light? And the other key to that is an amazing database we have now that I hope the teachers listening to this are able to draw on. It's called Your Story, Our Story, which is yourstory.tenement.org. There are 14,000 stories written, many by students all over the country, where they pick an object and they write about that object by way of sharing their family's migration story, whether it was their own story, their great-grandparents' story, you know, whether it was further back, whether it's their roots are Scandinavia or Mexico. Like, you see this amazing landscape on this database. And what we're trying to do is figure out what are ways we can bring some of those stories on site in programming, but also how do we extend this website and its curriculum and its use. We also have now virtual field trips, which are amazing ways to experience the tenement. If you're in Maryland or you're in Texas or Oregon, wherever you are, you can do a virtual field trip with us and meet the educators and see the building in pretty rich perspective through a technology called photogrammetry. And those are live programs. They're very affordable. It's just like the most accessible way, I think, to see the tenement. And so we want to kind of grow and extend our reach through some of these virtual programs, as well as growing our on-site visitation.
And it's such a dynamic organization and such a dynamic museum. Just fascinating. I've always wanted to chat with somebody from it. So I'm glad that we had the chance to do it. And I think also too, like sort of expanding beyond just the tenement is valuable as well, because I imagine a lot of New Yorkers in the 80s, the idea of a tenement was something that was very familiar. Like they grew up with that. They knew what that meant. And I think that even that term is beginning to lose some of its like memory. Like people are like, what is a tenement again? You know what I mean? And so connecting it to immigration stories and to people's stories all across the country, like what a powerful way of maintaining and preserving the memory of what this is and what it means to a new generation that may not be as familiar with that physical place or even that concept. So I think that's pretty cool. And I think there's a lot of lessons there for other organizations that perhaps preserve something that people aren't even as familiar with nowadays. How do you continue to maintain that relevance, which I know is a big part of the conversation in the preservation community, and I'm sure is in the museum community as well.
Absolutely. And I think it calls up this tension of how do you preserve the exciting particularities of a space, which fundamentally you're there to preserve, you're there to share knowledge of. And it's really what so many people who come to see it are fat. Once you step inside, you know, you're immersed in this historic space and you're asking all sorts of questions about the physical surroundings. And then, you know, once you can use that to spark the imagination to think about what was it like to live in a space like that, that then I think extends the story well beyond, because it's really then about how do families who never thought their stories would be told, how do they adapt to change and how do they build new lives? And these are, how do they preserve their culture? How do they talk from one generation to another? What are they thinking about their religion? What are they thinking about their language? These are universal dynamics that cut across, you know, wherever you come from, whether you're Joseph Moore and you came from Belvedere, New Jersey, or you're Adolfo Valdezzi and you came from Sicily, or you're Harris Levine from Poland. Like all of these people coming who moved into our tenements had to think about new ways of living, new ways of preserving their culture, new ways of organizing politically. Like that's what we're all doing, right? We're living in an age where everything is constantly changing. We're constantly having to think about like what's important to us, what we want to pass down. And so I think these questions are so relevant today.
Yeah. Definitely there's a relevance here, and exciting to see what you're doing. And I think for a lot of people listening who either work at museums or work in preservation, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned, and obviously a great place to visit and learn those lessons. So if people are in the New York area, I presume you have regular hours, you're open all the time with a staff that big, people can come and visit you. But what's the best way to get that information, and where can they find you online?
Sure. So just tenement.org. And we are open 7 days a week. We're only closed on Christmas, New Year's, and January 1st. It's the only day that I don't get email. It's kind of amazing. So we are open every day, 10 to 6 roughly. I would say if you're coming, it's always good to like book your tour ahead. And on the website, there's a pretty descriptive way of learning about the different tours. So it's always helpful to book ahead and just know you have that ticket. When you get here, there is a visitor center, a bookshop. There's also a film that's always running, like a 30-minute film that loops. It's a great, and also if you're interested and you're not able to come to the museum, this film, it was recently produced by PBS Treasures of New York that focuses on the tenement. And it's a great introduction to the museum, and that you can find easily online. But we hope you come visit us at the museum. And we hope the other way to find us is our YouTube station, our YouTube channel. We do public programs that are entirely free. And different historians talking about different immigration laws, for example, or we do musical concerts. So that's one way of finding us. And I hope that you do come visit. And I hope, Nick, you can come visit as well.
Well, this has been just awesome. And, you know, I think many of us listening are the children or the descendants of immigrants. And what a cool way to know that story is being told. And exciting here also to hear about how people across the country can engage in it and tell their stories and learn more about your work. And so we'll have links in the show notes to all of the websites that Annie mentioned. But it's been a pleasure chatting with you, and hope to get a chance to come see it sometime soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to PreserveCast. To dig deeper into this episode's story, head over to preservecast.org for show notes and our collection of previous episodes. Don't forget to engage with this podcast by subscribing, commenting, and leaving a review. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at PreserveCast for even more. PreserveCast is currently recorded in Walkersville, Maryland, and sponsored by the 1772 Foundation and powered by Preservation Maryland. Thanks for listening, and keep on preserving.